All right. Who here loves steak? I want you to raise your hand. Look at these hands. Based on the GroupMe chat this week, many people in this church love steak. Not only love steak, love talking about how they love steak. My son, Enoch, I think he lives for steak. He has kind of a restricted diet, but steak is one of the things he can eat, and he loves it. But one time, we were there with steak on the table, and he wasn't touching it. And I said, Enoch, what's the problem? How come you're not eating? He said, well, there's nothing to put on it. And it was true, actually. There wasn't seasoning. There wasn't salt. And so if you think about it, this wonderful thing that was so valuable to him, it was becoming worthless. He couldn't eat it. So, you know, let me ask you again. Supposing there wasn't any seasoning, there was no seasoning and that, you know, you cooked into it and there was no seasoning available, how many of you would love, look forward to eating that steak? Oh, some hardcore, but much fewer. You're allowed to raise your hand here even if you're a vegetarian. I know many vegetarians, they say they love steak, they just choose not to eat it. But I can bring you into vegetarians. If you're here and you're a vegetarian, how many of you really look forward and love eating tofu plain? Plain. Anybody? Was that a hand? No. Okay. No, we don't see it. You need seasoning. For even great things, you need the seasoning. You need salt. Salt will change the situation if it's there, and it'll change the situation if it's not there. You have to have salt. Well, Jesus Christ makes this his message about our attitude toward those who don't believe as we do. And he has a very strong word for us today from the Sermon on the Mount, and the message is about salt. So please stand if you're able to read with me. I'm going to be reading from Matthew chapter 5, from the old NIV version, 1984. And I'm going to be reading verses 13 through 16. Again, this is the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 13. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men so that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. This is the gospel of our Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. So I want to focus with you on verse 13, especially this morning. And it's a strong word that Jesus gives. It's another challenge from the Sermon on the Mount. And he's expressing this lack of saltiness as a serious problem, isn't he? He says, you know, if you lack saltiness, speaking to his disciples, then you're not good for anything. He's saying you're good for nothing. So this is something we need to hear, is it not? It's something we need to hear, but really understand what he's saying. What does our Lord mean here? And when we try to do that, we run into a problem, because salt is so elemental. There are many different meanings for salt or uses for salt. You know, you might have heard a message or read something in the ancient world. You might have heard that salt was primarily used as a preservative. And that's true, although, you know, it didn't take ancient people long to figure out that salt on something tasted good. You know, the ancient people were not dumb. So, yeah, they were using it as a flavoring as well. So what does Jesus mean here? If you say, I really want to understand this, so I'm not good for nothing. What does he mean? Does he mean that we flavor the world? That we, you know, bring out the flavor of something good, of good things in the world? Or does he mean that we preserve the world? Like, because we're there, things, you know, last longer? If you want to stick with the scriptures, you know, you can look in the Old Testament and find that salt was crucial to salt the sacrifice. When you offered a grain offering, you had to offer salt with it. So is that what Jesus is thinking about? Does he mean like we, you know, make sacrifice for the world, that we sacrifice ourselves for the world? I read one scholarly work, and he came up with 11 different uses for salt. You know, it's so common, it's so elemental that it becomes a common metaphor. It's, in the ancient world, it's often used as a metaphor for wisdom. Actually, it's commonly used when people talk about saltiness, they're talking about being wise. Is that possibly what Jesus is saying, that we, you know, bring wisdom to the world? You know, all these 11 uses that this scholar brought up, he still didn't hit the main one for me. You know, the main one, what I think of when somebody says salt to me, it's my driveway. You know, and so some of you, you come over and visit me, you come down that long driveway, and one of the first things that people say is, how is this in the winter? What do you do in the winter? And the answer is, we don't do anything if we don't have salt or we don't have someone to plow us out. So what's going on is very difficult here to know. It's very difficult to drill down. If you say, I really want to understand what this passage is saying, it's hard to drill down to get that meaning. So that's why we read a few more verses beyond that, because these analogies on the Sermon on the Mount are meant to inform each other. In fact, that's a good tip if you're reading the scriptures and you come to something that you don't understand. You're reading something that Jesus says and you say, I don't really understand that. It's a good idea to read around it, because very often he's talking about the same thing with another thing that he says. It helps us to understand it, or something happens that illustrates what he's teaching. And so we read after that, right? It talks about the light, not only salt, but Jesus makes this other comparison. You're the light of the world. And what was the point there? It's a little more clear, right? He's saying you don't take a light and put it under a bowl. You put it on a stand so that it is exposed to all of the people in the house. It brings light, right? So it's a matter of exposure that he's talking about with the salt too. So I thought that probably the person who best captured the main point of this passage was none other than Martin Luther, the great reformer, the great initiator of the Protestant Reformation. And he looked at this verse and he said, this is the main point. Luther said this, here's the main point of this passage. What the disciples are, they are not for themselves, but for the world. What the disciples are, they're not for themselves, but for the world. I think that captures what Jesus is getting at. Jesus, I don't think, is thinking about a particular use of salt, because there could be many different uses, but whatever salt quality you treasure, whatever salt quality you think of and you use, you're to be that, not for yourself, but for the world, if you're a disciple. That all the qualities of being a disciple, and there are many, those are there for the world. Those are there not for ourselves, but for contact with the world. The issue is contact. Now, it's a little bit weird what Jesus says here, the way he says it. You notice he says, if salt loses its saltiness, and actually, this is actually a very good translation here. It's kind of ambiguous, like loses its saltiness, loses its effect. Because that's weird, because salt can't really do that, right? Sodium chloride is a stable compound. It doesn't react, and its qualities are bound up in the sodium and the chloride and the bond between them. It's the chemical compound that gives it its properties, so it never loses its properties. Salt never becomes less of what it is. Good analogy for disciples. If you're a disciple of Christ, you don't lose what you are. But then what does Jesus mean here? If salt loses its saltiness, then it's not salt anymore. The salt never loses its properties. So how could he put it this way? What is he getting at here? Say salt loses its saltiness. And that, friends, brings us to where we might get salt. Where does salt come from if you're an ancient Israelite in the first century? Well, I know for us, we think, where does salt come from? We know where it comes from. It comes from the supermarket, right? We need some salt. What do? We go to the supermarket and buy a bag of salt or buy a container of salt, okay? But you realize that, just take a moment to think, they didn't have supermarkets in ancient Israel, so where did they get their salt? And the answer is, They got their salt from the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is a place where there is a lot of salt, great concentration of salt. In fact, the Dead Sea has a higher concentration of salt, 7 times higher than seawater. So that's why if you've ever been, you know, at the ocean and you get a mouthful of seawater, you say, that's awful. Just imagine 7 times that, 7 times the concentration of seawater. That's why people float so well in the Dead Sea. And, you know, it's very hard to stay vertical. You go swimming in the Dead Sea and you can't because your feet just, you know, float. Even if you don't float in other bodies of water like me, it's like I have a hard time floating. In the Dead Sea, you will float. Your feet go up. It's sort of like a recliner. So this guy is reading the paper here. Very, very high concentration of salt. And it's not really fun to go swimming in. I've done it several times, and you better not stay in there long, because the longer you stay in there, the more dehydrated you'll get, because there's so much salt, it leaches the water out of your body as you're swimming. So it's not like a refreshing thing, go swimming in the Dead Sea. You actually come out, you're more dehydrated than when you went in. Not pleasant at all. Nonetheless, busloads of people go and swim in the Dead Sea. You know, when it's a warm weather, you have, you know, busloads of tourists, busload after busload come to, I guess, so people could just say, I swam in the Dead Sea, you know, because it's a landmark. It's actually the lowest place on earth, that isn't underwater. It's the lowest place on the surface of the earth. It's below sea level. But that gives it another feature, and that is that it's not a place where salt just gathers. It's not just a repository for salt. It's a repository for a lot of different exotic minerals. It's kind of like Death Valley, if you've ever been to Death Valley in this country, below sea level. It becomes this place where a lot of different minerals collect. And that's the problem. It's not just salt at the Dead Sea that you find. You find a lot of different things. In fact, you know, celebrities and rich people go to a spa there. They have a special kind of reserve there where you can go get special treatments with exotic minerals, because a lot more is mixed in with the salt, and that's the problem. If you're getting salt from the Dead Sea, it might have impurities in it. It's liable to have other things mixed in with it. It's liable to be adulterated. And that is how salt loses its saltiness, if it has other things mixed in with it. So if even Jesus, he may be thinking about this when he says salt of the earth, that is salt that you get out of the earth around the Dead Sea, you might get impurities in it. So the salt is the thing that it is. It's not going to change. But if it's mixed in with a lot of impurities, it reduces the amount of contact that the salt has with the steak or with the tofu or with my driveway. And that's what makes salt less salty, because it has these adulterations. So the problem that he's talking about is adulterations. Okay? These things that get mixed in, when they get mixed in, it reduces the amount of contact that the salt has with what it is salting. So that's what Jesus is, I think, getting at. There are things that come into our lives, things that we have, that are adulterations that cut down on the contact. And that's what I want to explain with us, talk about this morning. 4 different adulterations that happen in a disciple's life that limits the effectiveness of his saltiness or her saltiness, that limits the contact. And you can imagine, I can imagine just Jesus waving his hand when he said this, you know. Again, this is the Sermon on the Mount, and we know when Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount, he gave it to 2 audiences. How do we know that? Because at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, it tells us, right at the beginning of Matthew chapter 5, how does it start? It says, "And seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he had sat down, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying." So what do you see? What are they? You see 2 audiences. Jesus had the reason he went up on the mountains because of the crowds. But then the disciples came around him, and he was teaching the disciples with the crowds listening in. So he was, his first audience was the disciples, but then he had all these crowds on the mountain listening in on what he was teaching the disciples. Two audiences. And by the way, that's actually how the Sermon on the Mount has functioned through history. Always two audiences, the church primarily with the world listening in to Jesus' teaching. So I can imagine him standing and saying, you disciples are the salt of, you know, the earth around you, of the world. You're the light of the world. You could just imagine him saying, all these people around you, you are to be in contact with them. You're to be unadulterated in your contact with them. Okay, so what are these adulterations? What are these ways that mess up the fact that we, what we are not for ourselves, but for the world, for those who don't believe as we do? Okay, I'm going to try to go quickly through the first two, because I don't really think there is much an issue for people here at Ironworks. But I want to just mention them because, you know, if the shoe fits, you know, you might wear it. But I'll try to go quickly through the first two. The first adulteration, way that our contact is limited so that we're not salty, is having so many other priorities that we just stop caring. We stop caring about people who are around us who don't know the excellency of Christ, who don't believe as we do. And that's because we fill up our lives with so many other priorities that this is no longer a priority for us. What's happening? We're just like the Dead Sea salt. There are impurities in it. There are other minerals that come in. And they might be good things, but they limit us so that we're not even thinking about this anymore. That, you know, it's not even an issue. It's not even a priority. These other people around us. And that's why every once in a while, it's just about every generation, the Christian church has this someone who comes forward with a clarion call and say, this needs to be a priority in their life. Maybe they write a book about it. And it makes a splash for a while as Christians are called back and reminded about this. I think back to the 1980s, for those of you around back then, there was this book that made a big splash, at least in the evangelical Christian community. It was called Out of the Salt Shaker, Into the World. I don't know how many of you remember that book, by Rebecca Manley Pippert. Great title. Out of the Salt Shaker, Into the World. She introduced to the Christian church the term lifestyle evangelism. That was her term, lifestyle evangelism, so that this is not as hard as you think for this saltiness to take place in your life, right? Then in the 1990s, you know, the church took a more kind of business-oriented model, perspective. They said we should be like businesses, and so there were business books, and, you know, I think it was Bill Hybels' book. I think the name of it was Contagious Christian, and Bill Hybels had his formula. It was a business formula for the church, and it was HP plus CC plus CP equals HI, and that stood for high potency plus clear communication plus close proximity. Yeah, you feel like you're in a business room with this, right? Right, you're in the boardroom. Equals high impact. And you really wanted to emphasize close proximity. And, you know, all of these different efforts, all these different periodic calls are trying to tell the church, remind the church, making non-believers a priority in your life. Contact with non-believers has to be, if you're a disciple of Jesus Christ, has to be a feature of your life. And it's actually much easier than you think for that to be the case. But anyway, that's the first adulteration that happens, kind of coming to a place of not caring, a lack of priority. Second adulteration, second way in which we become not salty, and that is a way of reading the scriptures, which I think brings us into error. I think there's a mistake that we make sometimes in reading certain scriptures. And we start to read things and we start to say, well, I think what God is telling me through this scripture verse is to withdraw from non-Christian friends, withdraw from the world. So you read in a place like 2 Corinthians 6, where Paul says, come out from among them. And you read that and you say, wow, it sounds like God is telling me I should withdraw from people who don't believe as I do. And you got to be careful. You need to read all of the Corinthian correspondence to make sure you understand what Paul is really saying in places like that. And so you may have to read, for example, 1 Corinthians 5, where Paul says, as I wrote to you, actually in another letter, as I wrote to you, that you should not associate with the sexually immoral, not at all meaning, Paul says, 1 Corinthians 5, not at all meaning the immoral of this world. So he clarifies there, and he says, you know, when I'm saying these things, I'm not saying you should withdraw and not have friends with those who are immoral. In fact, he goes on to list the people that he means you should have friends with. He says you should have friends who are immoral. You should be friends with swindlers. You should have swindlers in your life, is what he's saying. You should be friends with people who are idolaters. He says not at all meaning to withdraw from those folks. And you have to hear him say that so that you understand that when you hear these certain verses, like don't be unequally yoked, you realize that Paul is talking about really one of two specific situations. Either a situation of church discipline, where you have somebody who says, I am a follower of Christ, and I'm a Christian, but refuses to live as Christ tells us to live. He says in that situation, sometimes there needs to be a withdrawal. Or he says in a very serious lifetime commitment, like marriage or a business partnership, that will cause you to water down your faith. And those are the situations where you say, okay, there needs to be a separation here. But Paul makes it clear, no, I don't mean at all that you should have not have non-Christian friends. No, I want you to be involved with these people. We need to be involved in these people's lives. They need to be involved in our lives. So if you have a situation like that where you're coming to the scripture and that causes a question for you, a problem for you, come talk to me. Let's talk about it. I invite you to talk to me further about it offline. But that was the second adulteration. Third adulteration, and I think this hits a little bit closer to home with us. Third way in which we don't get out of the salt shaker, third obstacle to the close proximity that we need to have to fulfill these verses, to follow what Jesus is saying here, is that we are afraid of sinful influence. We're afraid of kind of a contamination. In spite of the fact that salt actually never actually becomes unsalty, it is what it is. But we have a fear of kind of having an influence on us that takes us in the wrong direction. That's something that can really crop up. I had a conversation with a guy, a friend of mine, not in this church, but he was saying, you know, I know myself, I can't go to a bar. He said, if I go to a bar, I know that I'm going to be tempted in a certain way. So I can't do that. I can't go to the bar. I just know myself. I don't trust myself. And I said to him, my friend, just what I would say to you. I understand that. I get that. If you're gonna be in a situation that leads you into sin, that leads you into doing something you know God doesn't want you to do, to lead you into excess, then don't go. Don't put yourself in that situation. So I wouldn't tell anybody to put themselves in a situation where they're sinning. Don't do that. But I said to my friend, you should realize that's not the end game. Like, you might have an area of growth, and all of us have areas of growth. All of us have ways in which we're tempted, and we need to be careful for that. We need to be careful how we're walking so that we don't sin. But we should realize that's not where we want to be. That's not where we're going. I said to my friend, because I knew his heart, I said, wouldn't it be better if you could go to a bar and not be tempted? Wouldn't you be more useful to the Lord in that circumstance? Because that's where we're going. That's the end game. So yes, if we have situations we shouldn't put ourselves in, yeah, we should just realize the goal is to get to a place where we can go and be exposed in places and be useful to the Lord, be salty, and not be tempted. That's where we want to end up. Some of you are really afraid for your children. I know. Some of you are like looking at the craziness in the world, and you're saying, I need to shield my children from this. I need to put up a blockade or something. Things are so crazy. I need to make sure, I need to protect my children from this. What would I say to you? Well, I would say yes and no. Yes, in the sense that, yeah, you need to be wise. You need to be sure you don't put your children into a situation for which they're not prepared. Of course, you need to think about that and how that happens. So you don't want to just throw your kids out into, you know, the Dead Sea or wherever and say, okay, float. Well, actually, you could do that, but you want to throw your kids out into the world and say, okay, you make it good. Yeah, you need to protect if they're not ready for it. But I will tell you this, as somebody who raised four children in New York City, it was so great. They were all here last week. I hope some of you got a chance to talk to them and their wives. I will tell you this, if you think that you are going to keep your children in the faith by shielding them from their culture, that is not how it works. It's not how it works. If you want to know the determining factor, if you want your children to embrace the excellency of Christ as adults, the determining factor, well, first of all, it's a matter of grace. It's a matter of grace that any of us embrace Christ as adults. But if you want to say, well, what? How much of the part of it that depends on me, you want to know the largest determining factor in that. It is your relationship with them. It's not how much you're shielding them from the culture. It's your relationship with them. It's whether you can step into their world at every stage, and help them to interpret the culture that they're in. That's what makes the difference. You know, we should talk more about this. Let's talk more about this another time. But I will say for us today that it really comes down to your own attitude toward culture, toward your culture, and that begins with these verses here that Jesus is telling us. So, you know, it was great. I want to really say thank you to Ironworks Church for helping us to celebrate last week this moment of you know, stepping into this role of associate pastor. It was really great. It was wonderful. We had people from all the way back from the Village Church come and visit. That was really meaningful to me, really moved me. And it brought back memories. There was one time where I said to one of my elders, I said, look, I'd like to spend some time with you. Would you have some time on Saturday? Could you meet me at 2:00 on a certain street corner on Saturday? And he said, sure, you know, and so we were going to get together, spend some time on, you know, going to 12th Street and 7th Avenue. We're just going to spend some time together. And so we were talking, and then we were saying goodbye, and he said, okay, I'll see you Saturday, 2 p.m., I'll see you there. And I said, oh, no, wait, I didn't mean 2 p.m. I meant 2 a.m. And he said, at 2:00 a.m.? I said, yeah. He said, okay. He was a great sport, this guy. Great sport, this elder. And so, sure enough, he showed up this street corner, this one street corner, 2 a.m. in the morning. I said, okay, now we're going to go to a transvestite party. And he said, okay. Like I said, he was a great sport, this guy. His name was Elliot. And he was a big, tall guy, you know, from Texas, red hair. He was just a great sport, and we had a certain amount of trust. So he was like, okay. So we went to this transvestite party, and we had a really good time. We had very good conversations with folks. Now, I know that when I say that, I'm being a little bit old-fashioned. I know you're not supposed to use that word now, transvestite. I realize that. That's not a term you use anymore in polite conversation because it doesn't fit the narrative. But let me just say that in those days, it wasn't so long ago, that is how the party was billed. That is how the organizers of the party wanted to be identified. It's not me calling them transvestites, it's them calling them transvestites. And in fact, that word actually gets at the reason why most people still, even today, why most people cross-dress, who cross-dress. But anyway, we were at this party, and I just was so proud of this elder. As I say, he was a really great sport, and just the kind of disparate images, the incongruity here of this guy who's very preppy, kind of involved in finance, here speaking with these transvestites. It was just priceless. And it was getting late at a certain time, you know, and I'm thinking, gosh, I gotta preach tomorrow. And so I said, well, we gotta go. So, you know, we'll see you, go so long. And they said, No, you can't go yet, because we haven't had our show. Like, we're going to have our show. So you need to see our show. And I'm thinking, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. It's like, when exactly do these shows happen? You know, it's already 4 o'clock in the morning. So I was like, I'm sorry, we can't stay for the show. We have church tomorrow. I'll never forget. One of them, he took out this cross that he, she, whatever, was wearing. He showed it. He said, oh, you go to church? He wanted to show me the cross. He said, you go to church? He said, would you pray for me? So would you pray for me? I said, most assuredly, we will pray for you. In fact, we will be praying that we see you one of these days in church with us sometime. Friends, you do not need to fear. The one who is inside of you is greater than anything you're going to come up against in the world, anything. That's adulteration number three. Adulteration number four, to being salty, is fear of conflict. And this is very relevant for us today, is that we fear that we are going to talk to people who disagree with us, talk to people who don't believe as we do, and it's just going to be a conflict, and we don't want the conflict. And friends, if you listen to the media, you get the impression that you just cannot talk to anybody today. You can't talk to anybody who has a different opinion than you do. And you get that idea. It's just not true. It's not true that you can't talk to anybody. We think that we're just going to have conflict. Listen, we, of all people, should know how to talk to people who disagree with us. Of all people, disciples of Christ should be the people who know how to do that. And that is why we do what we do here at Ironworks Church. That's why we talk about things here that we're not really supposed to talk about. And hopefully we try to talk about truth, those truths with grace. And that's why, you know, during COVID crazy, what did we do? We did our Iron Sharpens Iron events, right? Because we wanted to say, look, how do we deal with disagreement, even among ourselves? And, you know, we talked about that in the session. It could have been done, you know, we could have done certain things better. We could have, you know, gone further. But it was a step. We were trying to take a step to say, look, if we have disagreements even among ourselves, we can learn to talk to one another with grace, with respect. And it was helping us to actually talk to those who are on the outside. But this is what we do. Those of you who are kind of thinking about membership here, we have a number of folks here we know who are kind of considering joining. You know, this is what we're about here. We're not here to kind of pat each other on the back. We're here to learn together how to engage our culture. And that is what we're about here. So, you know, a few weeks ago, I took a walk with a guy in his church who was, you know, bothered by certain things that I said during a sermon. And wasn't sure he agreed with things that I said during the sermon. So, you know, we took a walk together, and, you know, he was like, well, this is the things that came up for me, I was bothered by. I said, well, this is where I was coming from in that. Does that help you to understand? And he said, yeah, that's actually very helpful. And we had some great time kind of back and forth. And you know what? It was terrific. I don't know if he came like to agree with everything. You know, but he had things to think about. I had things to think about. I felt very respected. I felt, you know, very respected by the whole thing. It was terrific. It reminded me, I said, you know, this reminds me of Colossians 4. the way this man's conducting himself. It reminds me of Colossians 4, where Paul says, "Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with," what? Salt. This is the Apostle Paul drawing on the teaching of our Lord Jesus Christ. He says, "Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person." Each person. If you do not know how to speak to someone who disagrees with you, then I'm afraid Jesus is describing you in verse 13, verse 13b, second half of the verse. Not good for things, thrown out, trampled. Well, you know, the best thing about the Sermon on the Mount, besides being very challenging for us, challenge after challenge after challenge, is that it helps us to know Jesus. You know? If we listen well to the Sermon on the Mount, we learn much about Jesus Christ himself. You know, because what he teaches, he embodies. And when he expresses something, he is teaching something, it's because it is about him and what he has done. The reason that we need to be unadulterated is because he was so salty. In fact, that's the meaning of the incarnation. His whole mission was to get close to us, to get close to us, to have contact with us, really deep contact with us, extensive contact with us. Even at times, you know, though we're distasteful at times. That's what his mission was. And that's why, by the way, his sacrifice means anything for us. You know, another use of salt, I mentioned the Old Testament sacrifices. You had to have salt with the sacrifice, right? So Leviticus 2 says, quote, "You shall season all your grain offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt." So you see, salt had to salt the grain offering sacrifice, had to be a part of it. Why? What was teaching us there? Because of the ultimate sacrifice, the one made by Jesus Christ, for it to be effective in our lives, for his death to mean anything for us, he had to be close to us. He had to be salty in us, with us. And so he flavored us by taking a body like ours. He preserved us by dying a death like ours. And then it was his willingness to mix it up with us that gives traction to his redemption in our lives. It's what redeems us. So that all the ways, if you're sitting there convicted now, all the ways in which we fail to take God's priorities, all the ways in which we are adulterated, he forgives because he overcame it with his own saltiness. That's the reality that we're living in. So if you refuse these words, if you say, this is for me, you're actually refusing the essence of the gospel. This is the essence of the gospel. That's why Jesus' words are so strong about it. We don't have to be good for nothing here at Ironworks Church. I know you. Let's be what Jesus is calling us to be. Let's salt his sacrifice. We do it by simply making non-believers a priority in our lives, being able to spend time with people who don't believe as we do, to be in their lives. How do we do that? We do that by receiving his life for us. And that's what we're going to be doing now in coming to the communion table. We do it by allowing his saltiness into us to make us salty. So let's receive that life in the communion bread and the communion cup so we can be in contact with the steak, with the tofu, with my driveway. Amen. Please stand with me.